Daniel 1. Let us hear God's word. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem, and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, with part of the vessels of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar, to the house of his God. And he brought the vessels into the treasure house of his God. And the king spake unto Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel, and of the king's seed, and of the princes, children in whom was no blemish, but well favored, and skillful in all wisdom and cunning in knowledge and understanding science, and such as had ability in them to stand in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the learning and the tongue of the Chaldeans. And the king appointed them a daily provision of the king's meat, and of the wine which he drank, so nourishing them 3 years, that at the end thereof they might stand before the king. Now among these were of the children of Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, unto whom the prince of the eunuchs gave names, for he gave unto Daniel the name Belteshazzar, and to Hananiah of Shadrach, and to Mishael of Meshach, and of Azariah, Abednego. But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's meat, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now God had brought Daniel into favor and tender love with the prince of the eunuchs. And the prince of the eunuchs said unto Daniel, I fear my lord the king, who hath appointed your meat and your drink. For why should he see your faces worse liking than the children which are of your sort? Then shall ye make me endanger my head to the king. Then said Daniel to Melzar, whom the prince of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, prove thy servants, I beseech thee, 10 days, and let them give us pulse to eat and water to drink. Then let our countenances be looked upon before thee, and the countenance of the children that eat of the portion of the king's meat, and as thou seest, deal with thy servants. So he consented to them in this matter, and proved them 10 days. And at the end of 10 days their countenances appeared fairer and fatter in flesh than all the children which did eat the portion of the king's meat. Then Melzar took away the portion of their meat, and the wine that they should drink, and gave them pulse. As for these 4 children, God gave them knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. Now at the end of the days that the king had said he should bring them in, then the prince of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king communed with them, and among them all was none found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore stood they before the king, and in all matters of wisdom and understanding that the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers that were in all his realm. And Daniel continued even unto the first year of King Cyrus. Thus ends the reading of God's holy and infallible word. Lord's Day morning, return again to a series of messages on the Old Testament, surveying the Old Testament. We come this morning to the prophet Daniel. We had looked at the historical books all the way from Genesis up through 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 Kings. We considered that united kingdom in 1 and 2 Samuel, the first part of 1 Kings. Then we considered the divided kingdom after Solomon's reign, his son Rehoboam takes charge, and Jeroboam is involved in a schism where the 10 tribes of the north follow him. And then from 930 B.C. to 722 B.C., the two kingdoms are divided until the Assyrians come and defeat Samaria, the northern capital, in 722 B.C. From that point on, 722 to 561, we had the remaining kingdom in 2 Kings 18 through 25. We just considered those remaining kings of Judah up till the first departure of the people of God in 605, in which Daniel took part, in which we read just read of here in Daniel 1. But 2 Kings takes us a little bit further to about 561 or so B.C. We considered two Lord's days ago, Jeremiah, his prophecy, and then his poetry, the Book of Lamentations, leading up to the departure of Daniel and the ultimate fall of Jerusalem in 585 about. So now we come to Daniel. Daniel is in Babylon. He's been taken to Babylon. We'll consider his prophecy this morning. Lord willing, next week we'll look at Ezekiel, who was his contemporary, who was there with him in Babylon during the captivity. And we'll also consider the short book of Obadiah, which is a curse upon the people of Edom, who laughed, who jeered when Jerusalem fell. Now, let's introduce this book of Daniel. First, the name of the book is obviously Daniel, after the main character of the book. Daniel means the judgment of God. He's from the tribe of Judah. He is obviously in the royal family, and that's why he and his companions are taken and considered for the court of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar renames him, as well as his three companions, gives them Babylonian names. And so he takes the name Belteshazzar. Now, we might at first assume the author of the book is Daniel, given the name of the book is Daniel. But the fact is that in the historical sections of this book, chapters 1 through 6, Daniel is referred to in the third person. He's not saying I. It's referring to he. We see this in Daniel 6:28. It's hard to imagine Daniel would have written this of himself. So this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. So though the book may be based on his journals or his diary, it looks like someone else probably compiled it and finalized it. I wonder myself if it might be Ezra who would have gathered this material at the return of the people from captivity. But we can't be certain of that. But obviously someone has touched it up under the inspiration of God and the guidance of God. Now, as I said before, as we consider the background of this book, Jeremiah and Ezekiel are contemporaries of Daniel. Jeremiah continued to preach even after this period where Daniel and Ezekiel go up to Babylon. It appears that Daniel went first, then Ezekiel likely in the second captivity. During that time, Jeremiah is still preaching in Judah and in Jerusalem. But Daniel and Ezekiel are in Babylon, and they are preaching to the people of God that have been taken there. It's very interesting. We have Daniel referred to in the book of Ezekiel on two occasions. In chapter 14, he is spoken of, and God, through Ezekiel, says that he's going to destroy this nation. And he says, even if there were godly men like Daniel, Noah, or Job there, that wouldn't be enough to keep God from chastening his people and taking them into captivity. So it's interesting that his godliness is compared with Noah and Job. Noah and Job have been dead for a lot of years at this point. And Daniel is alive, and God, through Ezekiel, says, you know, this was going to happen regardless of whether we had Daniel amongst us or Job amongst us or Noah amongst us. So it says something pretty significant about the known godliness of Daniel amongst the people of God. We also find God using Ezekiel to speak to the prince of Tyre in chapter 28. And rhetorically, he says to the prince of Tyre, thou art wiser than Daniel. In other words, he's kind of, you think you are. You think you're pretty smart. You think you're wiser than Daniel. So Daniel's wisdom appears to be well known amongst the people of God and potentially even amongst the enemies of God. Now, it's interesting that this book in the Hebrew Bible is not in the prophets, it's in the writings. Because Daniel is not just a prophet, he's also a statesman prophet. And he's certainly bivocational here, and he has a job to, and when God He has a certain gift to be able to interpret dreams and visions. He also, we'll see in chapter 7 through 10, has a prophetic gift. Jesus speaks of him as Daniel the prophet in Matthew 24:15, as Jesus is speaking of the abomination of desolation that would take place in AD 70. He speaks of Daniel prophesying of that in Daniel chapter 9. He calls him Daniel the prophet. So he was a statesman. He certainly was a prophet. He served under the Babylonian Empire and a significant portion of ancient Medo-Persian Empire. Served under many kings or emperors, four of which are listed in the book: Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar, the first and the last kings or emperors of the Babylonian or the Chaldean Empire. Then he also served under Darius and Cyrus, the first king and his deputy king or vice president, so to speak, Darius. Let me explain that. Darius, it says in the book that Darius first ruled in Babylon before Cyrus. Well, that's true because Darius was Cyrus's father-in-law and second in command. And when Cyrus, his army, had defeated Babylon, Cyrus went on with the armies to wage other wars further east and left his father-in-law, aged Darius, in charge in Babylon. So it's basically like having the vice president at home and the president's out with the warriors out on the field. But Daniel, we'll see, serves under both of their leadership. We also find in this book three particular places where Nebuchadnezzar's proclamations are incorporated right into the book. We'll see that happen again in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, where the authors there have at least access to the official records of the Medo-Persian Empire. And so clearly Daniel himself, or the author of this book, would have as well had access to those. Now, what's the purpose of this book? William Hendrickson says of this book, it can be entitled God's Sovereignty in History and Prophecy. In history and prophecy. He divides the book, I think, accurately into two sections: the historical sections, 1 through 6, and then the prophetic section, 7 through 10. So history, prophecy. The only problem with the title that Hendrickson gives is that God is sovereign in history that's happened, and He's sovereign in history that's yet to happen. And that's the way we should look at prophecy. History that is yet to happen, but is already laid out in the counsels of God. So we'll have first God's sovereignty in history, the historical section, chapters 1 through 6. Let's survey that briefly. These first four chapters occur under Nebuchadnezzar's reign. What we find in this book is the first six chapters are chronological in that they're historical. Okay, but when you get to chapter 7 and following, it doesn't continue the chronology. It goes back and deals with the four visions that Daniel had in chronological order. But he returns all the way to Belshazzar's reign to begin that discussion. So we'll see Nebuchadnezzar, chapters 1 through 4, then Belshazzar, chapter 5, then Darius in chapter 6. Then we'll step back, and in chapters 7 and 8, we'll look at two visions that Daniel had while he served Belshazzar. Then in chapter 9, a vision that he had while he served under Darius. And then 10, 11, and 12, which is one vision that he served while he served under Cyrus. Okay, so first six chapters historical, the next six prophetical. Chapters 1 through 6. God's sovereignty in history. First, chapter 1, under Nebuchadnezzar, we have a test of character. Daniel and his friends refuse to partake of this food that obviously has been sacrificed to idols. They're willing to obtain a good secular education. They don't refuse that. They recognize that God has sovereignly brought them under the dominion of Nebuchadnezzar. They're prepared to submit. They're prepared to undergo this secular education so that they might be culturally literate amongst the Babylonians, so that they can be influential amongst them. But what they will refuse to do is to partake of the sacramental food of the heathen. And so this doesn't appear to be a dietary issue. It appears to be a worship issue. And they're willing to die for it. But in this chapter, we see Daniel's sophistication. He's smart. He's sly. He doesn't file a protest immediately. He doesn't set up a boycott amongst all the Jews in Babylon, or a phone-in campaign or a write-in campaign. He just says, well, Can we try this? Let's see how it works. You might be surprised. You might find that this is beneficial for us. And with that strategy, the Lord allows them to succeed in that. Then in chapter 2, we have another event during Nebuchadnezzar's reign. Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. He has a dream that he's seen this great colossus of a man, that's gold in his head, then silver, then bronze, and then clay. He asks for the interpretation. None of his wise men can interpret it, but eventually they recognize Daniel can. Daniel explains it to Nebuchadnezzar. He says, this golden head is you, and it's the Neo-Babylonian kingdom. He says there's going to be another kingdom that's going to come on the scene, the Medo-Persian kingdom. Then another kingdom, which obviously in history was the Macedonian and Grecian kingdom under Alexander the Great. And he speaks of another kingdom that will come. That would be the kingdom of Rome. He says, you saw that great colossus, but you also saw this little stone that comes, hits this great colossus, this great idol, so to speak, and it is shattered, it's brought to dust, and that little stone becomes a great mountain. He says, this is the picture of the kingdom of God. It's a picture of Christ and His kingdom. So just look at chapter 2, verses 44 and 45. You get a taste of the interpretation of this vision. And in these days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom, which shall never be destroyed. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. For as much as thou sawest that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it brake in pieces the iron, the brass, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God hath made known to the king what shall come to pass hereafter. And the dream is certain, and the interpretation thereof sure. So here, Nebuchadnezzar is given a glimpse of what's going to take place over a period of more than 500 years. His kingdom's great, but another one's coming after that, another one's coming after that. There'll be other nations that dominate. People will be left to those kingdoms. And so there'll be another kingdom that comes on the scene. That kingdom's going to last forever. Its people are never going to be left to another king that'll eventually come along. And so here we have Christ in the forefront of this prophecy, or this vision that was given to Nebuchadnezzar and its interpretation. Then in chapter 3, we have another event during Nebuchadnezzar's reign. This is related to Daniel's three friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, sometimes better known as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego after their Babylonian names. Okay? Guess what Nebuchadnezzar does after he sees this great vision, and God through Daniel tells him, you and your nation's the golden head. There's going to be another nation that comes, and another that rules, and another that rules, and has to, you know, and it causes your kingdom to disintegrate. But your kingdom's the golden head. The other kingdoms go take over you. They're not going to be quite as majestic, quite as significant as you. They're not quite as beautiful as you. You know, they're going to dominate you, but culturally they're not as magnificent as you. Well, proud Nebuchadnezzar makes an image of himself in gold. And he requires worship of that image. And so Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah will not bow down to that image. We read that that image was set up in the plains. It wasn't right there in Babylon. We have to assume that Daniel was in Babylon, or potentially Shushan, the summer palace. But he wasn't present, apparently. And so these men are cast into the fiery furnace. Remember, children, what happens when Nebuchadnezzar looks into that fiery furnace? Remember these three men, they say, listen, we're not bowing down. You know, they gave him a second chance. We're not bowing down. We believe our God can save us, but even if he doesn't, we're willing to die for it. That's basically what they said. He throws them into the fire. What happens? They don't burn up. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar looks in there, and what does he see? How many men does he see? He sees four men. Four men there. Because one looks as he says, an angel or as a son of God, I think. I don't remember the exact reference, but it's clear that it was Jesus there with them. They come out, and then they're honored for their courageous stand. They were tested in their character, and they remained faithful. Then in chapter 4, we have another event. Nebuchadnezzar has another dream. He dreams of this great tree that grows. And then it's eventually uprooted and torn down. And again, no one can explain it but Daniel. Daniel says, you and your kingdom are this great tree. In other words, many people prosper under your reign. And yet, because of your pride, you're going to be pulled down. This tree's going to be pulled down. And then it's fulfilled in Nebuchadnezzar having a situation arise where he becomes like an animal. And he's forced out into the wilderness and behaves just like an animal. There have been other documented cases of this, even in the last 500 years, of individuals that have had this unique situation, so-called disease, for lack of a better term, but some kind of psychological problem, clearly. But we see in this that Nebuchadnezzar humbles himself. Many believe that he even is converted under this great humiliation of God. He can say in chapter 4, 34 and 35, at the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, now this is a public decree that Nebuchadnezzar made. This wasn't just what he told Daniel. This went out to everyone in his kingdom. The end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up mine eyes unto heaven, and mine understanding returned unto me. And I blessed the Most High, and I praised and honored him that liveth forever, whose dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation. And all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing, and he doeth according to his will in the army of heaven, and among the inhabitants of the earth, and none can stay his hand or say unto him, what doest thou? It seems that Nebuchadnezzar had a significant change of mind regarding the God that the Jews served. Now, this event doesn't correspond well to secular history. We can't really discern this situation in secular history. Well, why might that be? You have to remember that the kings of Babylon, they would have been in a position where they routinely would not have been amongst the people. They would have been held up in their own palace. Very few people would have seen them. You get a picture of that in the book of Esther, where Esther, the queen, has to be welcomed into the king's presence. And part of the aura of the king himself, and that the king as a semi-god, was the fact that he wasn't among the people. People didn't get to see him. They didn't get to realize he had to put his pants on just like they did. And so that was part of the whole aura. So it appears that his cabinet kind of kept his hush-hush when this occurred. People didn't realize that the king was gone for a while. He's out in the woods behaving like an animal. But he comes back and makes this decree, and I think indeed if he was converted, we ought to understand that this is pretty late in his reign. And so his conversion, potentially, we don't necessarily see have much impact in his seed on the next generations, if we're to understand that he indeed was converted. Then in chapter 5, we have an event during Belshazzar's reign. Now, two other kings served between Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar. One, a very short reign, less than a year, and then another king named Cambyses, who apparently is referred to as Artaxerxes, not by his name, but by his title in the book of Ezra in the early chapters. But then you have Belshazzar. We have another test of gift. Daniel has had to, thus far, interpret two of Nebuchadnezzar's dreams. Well, now he's tested to interpret the handwriting on the wall at the party that Belshazzar has in the palace in Babylon. But I think we have to recognize the setting of this party. The fact is, the Medo-Persians have surrounded the city of Babylon and have sieged it and have surrounded it for quite a long time, for over a couple of years. And the Babylonians are so confident that they will not be taken that they're having a party, a wild party. And we see just at the end of the party, when God writes these words, "Meeni, meeni, tekel, upharsin," we see in verse 25, and Daniel's called and explains what this means, meaning, "God hath numbered thy kingdom and finished it. Tekel, thou art weighed in the balances and found wanting. Peres, thy kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians." And then we have Belshazzar blessing Daniel, but them being taken. It doesn't say much concerning that in the chapter. Just read summary statement in verses 30 and 31. "In that night was Belshazzar the king of the Chaldeans slain, and Darius the Median took the kingdom, being about 62 years old." So Darius under Cyrus and his army come in. Apparently they snuck in through the water conduits, and they were right within the citadel and within the palace before they were even recognized that they had invaded the city. And it was a very easy coup, apparently, as we see it explained in secular history. Then in chapter 6, now we have an event during Daniel's life during the King Darius' period. And this is the Daniel in the lion's den event. Daniel has served in the Babylonian kingdom. Now he comes to the Medo-Persian kingdom. Apparently they still think very highly of him. Darius has him in a high place. But guess what? Some of the other men in the cabinet, some of the leaders and influential men under Cyrus and Darius, they're pretty jealous of this Jew's influence. So they figure, how can we get to this guy? And they conclude that this man is such a man of integrity, the only way to get to him is to have a law passed that contradicts the law of his God. Then he will have to violate it. They recognize that the man is obedient to God, and he will thus be obedient to those who are over him in authority. And so he will be obedient to them in the civil sphere, but only so much as so he can keep his conscience regarding his God. So these men were pretty shrewd, and they recognized how Daniel operated. And so they caused a law to be passed where he could not worship the true God. And yet he continued, it says, as was his custom, to go to his house and to worship God. Many believe that worship that he engaged in was family worship. You have to realize at this point, this is Daniel under Darius. Daniel is at least in his 70s, maybe 80s at this point. This is not a young man being thrown into the lion's den. He's not a little kid anymore. But we see him remaining faithful again. So we have 6 vignettes, 6 little events in history over Daniel's long life, 5 of them really involving him directly, 1 particularly involving his 3 friends, Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael. Now we move to the second part of the book, God's Sovereignty and Prophecy, chapter 7 through 12. Now, chapter 7 is a prophecy that God gives to Daniel in Belshazzar's reign. So we step back a little bit. We're back into the Babylonian kingdom, the last Babylonian king, Belshazzar. And we're told that Daniel has a vision of four beasts. We understand these four beasts to be the four kingdoms of the great Colossus in chapter 2. The Babylonians, the Medo-Persians, the Grecians, and then the Romans. But we also learn about a little horn amongst the Roman kingdom. Now some believe this little horn is a reference to the Antichrist. I think if you take this book in its context, it's more likely that this little horn is referring to the Caesars and to their great persecution of the church during the apostolic or the post-apostolic period. But either way, we see that this little horn that grows out of Rome is an enemy of the church. In 7:13 and 14, we have a beautiful picture of Jesus Christ that was seen by Daniel. I saw in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven, and came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. So here we have the Son and the Father being portrayed. And there was given him, the Son of Man, dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all people, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed. Another picture of Christ and his kingdom. Then in chapter 8 we have another vision under Belshazzar, during Belshazzar's reign. The vision of a ram and the goat. The ram is the Medo-Persian Empire. The goat is the Grecian Empire under Alexander the Great. And we see that the goat gets the best of the ram. But then we see that from the goat there are four streams that come out. And that are, those are the four nations that Alexander's kingdom was divided into, the four great generals. And then we read of a little horn. And that little horn apparently refers to an individual named Antiochus Epiphanes, who was a king of the Seleucid dynasty, and who reigned from 175 to 163 B.C. and persecuted the Jews, particularly for about a three-year period near the very end of his reign. So, we're given a picture of the warfare that's yet before the people of God. They're going to live through the Medo-Persians, the Greeks, the Romans. They're going to have to live through the persecution of the Caesars under the Roman Empire. They're going to have to live under the persecution of Antiochus Epiphanes in the Grecian army. Then in chapter 9, we have another vision given Daniel under Darius's reign. What we see here at the beginning of the book is that Daniel, at this period, is reading in the book of Jeremiah. And he reads in the book of Jeremiah from chapter 25 and 29:10, and comes to realize that the Babylonian captivity will be 70 years. And so he begins to pray that the 70 years would be over and that the Babylonian captivity would be over. It's very quickly approaching. And then we have this vision of 70 sevens, which will take Daniel from the present time, about 535 to AD 70. Now some believe this 70 sevens to be quite literal. So they believe that this is referring to exactly 490 years. To do that, and to see that the end of this 490 years occurs in 33.5 AD, approximately, you know, when Christ is crucified, means that Daniel had to be living in 453 BC when this prophecy took place. So there's a discrepancy of about 80 years this is to be understood literally. Now, those that hold this position have a pretty strong argument. That argument is that they've concluded, their deduction, they conclude that the kings during the Medo-Persian period claimed their reigns from their birth to their death, not from the birth of their father to their death. So in other words, they're contending, some would contend that during that period, these reigns really were about 20 to 30 years shorter. And if you take those few kings and those few reigns and shorten it up, which we don't have a lot of historical records during this period, it's possible. But it's also possible to understand that this is not to be taken in quite that wooden of a literal form. But clearly, it refers to things that will take place in the future. There's a reference clearly to the wall being completed 49 years later under Nehemiah, and that does take place. There's certainly a reference to Christ being anointed in 30 A.D. in His baptism, His anointing as the priest. And then we clearly have a reference to His finished work on the cross 3.5 years later, and then the destruction of Jerusalem that would occur 36 years later in 70 A.D. We see all that in verses 24 through 27 in particular. We do find that at the end of this period, it will be in verse 24, to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins. Sounds like Christ's work. To bring in everlasting righteousness. That sounds like Christ's work. To seal up the vision and prophecy. Put a close to the canon. And to anoint the Most Holy. Again, God the Father anointing Christ. And so it goes on and speaks of Messiah the Prince who would come, which would be cut off in verse 26. Would make an end of the sacrifices, who would confirm the covenant in verse 27. And in the midst of that week, He shall cause the sacrifice and oblation to cease. Remember the temple veil being ripped in two. And so then it goes on, and for the overspreading of abominations, He shall make it desolate, even unto the consummation, and that determined shall be poured upon the desolate. Apparently a reference to 70 A.D. Because the sacrificial system wasn't understood by the Jews to be completed, God helps them understand by completing it for them, by destroying the temple. So we have those three visions. Then the fourth vision, chapters 10 through 12, during Cyrus's reign. In chapter 10, 1 through 11, 1, we have him, Daniel, meeting with Christ. Listen to how Christ is spoken of in 10, 5. Then I lifted up mine eyes and looked, and behold, a certain man clothed in linen, whose loins were girded with fine gold of Uphaz. Sounds a little bit like the descriptions of Jesus that we have in the book of Revelation. We don't see a lot of this same terminology of book of Revelation here in Daniel to start. Then in 11, 2 through 4, we have a prophecy of the establishment of the Grecian Empire. Then in 11, 5 through 20, wars between Egypt and Syria after the Grecian Empire ceases. Then from verses 21 to 35, we learn more about Antiochus Epiphanes, who will persecute the Jews, as I said, from about 168 to 165 B.C. That's the period of the Maccabees. We have two apocryphal books of the Maccabees who were patriotic Jews during this period and were involved in a resistance movement, so to speak, amongst the Jews. Then in verses 36 of chapter 11 through 12:1, we have the Roman Empire and what would happen under Titus in 70 A.D. Then briefly in 12:2 and 3, I believe we have a picture of the resurrection and heaven. And many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. Here we have the resurrection, the judgment, the resurrection. And they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament. Here's a picture of heaven, the eternal state for those in glory. Then in verses 13 and following, we have another reference to Antiochus Epiphanes and the period of time that would exist. It's actually the number of days between him stopping the sacrificial system for a period in 168, 167 B.C. up till the time that he actually put the idol Jupiter into the sanctuary, in the Holy of Holies. And then we have these final words in verse 13 to Daniel himself. But go thy way, but go thou thy way, till the end be. In other words, God has told him much about the end, but he's saying you're going to have to go your own way. You're going to die. For thou shalt rest and stand in thy lot at the end of thy days, or the days. So he's telling Daniel, you're going to die and you're going to rest. But eventually you're going to stand in your lot, actually kind of in your own estate, in your own property. It's a reference to the mansions that Christ has promised for his people. So Daniel, you're going to rest, and yet you're going to have another rest in body and soul. When's that going to take place? At the end of the days at Christ's return, when time is no more and it's swallowed up in eternity. So a summary of the book, first six chapters historical, the next six books are six chapters prophetical about history to come for Daniel. Now briefly in application, let me just mention six major themes of this book. This book does uniquely give us a philosophy of history all by itself. It first deals with the sovereignty of God, does it? The sovereignty of God in bringing the kingdom of God in the fullness of time under the Roman Empire. We see the stone destroying the kingdoms. We see the tree uprooted, the interpretation of the writing. God is sovereign in all these things. He rules and reigns. Secondly, we see the centrality of Christ. Christ is that fourth man in the furnace. He's the angel in the lion's den. He's the one that will have a decisive victory and will bring in the kingdom, His kingdom, which will remain. Then we also see in this book the reality of warfare. The church is at war with its enemies. We see the enemies being the Caesars in chapter 7. We see the enemy being Antiochus Epiphanes in chapter 8 and 11. In chapter 12, 1, we see the enemy being the Roman general Titus as they come and destroy the temple in 70 A.D. But we also see a personal warfare going on. We see that in chapter 1 with Daniel and his companions. We see it in chapter 3 with Daniel and his companions. We find it again in chapter 6 when the cabinet members under Darius are jealous of Daniel and want to bring him to death. So we need to be prepared to remind ourselves of this little poem, likely a song. Dare to be Daniel. Dare to stand alone. Dare to have a purpose firm. Dare to make it known. Daniel was a man of integrity for sure in this warfare. But in this warfare, I think there are three more themes that we find. One is the importance of worship. It's a worship issue in chapter 1. And we find in chapter 2, when Daniel's asked to interpret, he calls he and his companions instinctively go to prayer. We find Daniel's pattern in chapter 6, three times a day, prayer. He was consistently involved in that habit, which was a privilege to meet with God. We see in chapter 9, him reading the book of Daniel and responding to it and praying the promise. You see, he was mastered by the Word. Daniel mastered the Word and the Word mastered him. And that's at the heart of his integrity. Consider the words of Daniel 11, 32b and 33a. The people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. And they that understand among the people shall instruct many. Daniel knew his God. He did great things for God. He also taught the people of God about God. So the importance of worship. Secondly, the unique place of the Christian in society. Daniel was not afraid of being involved in the world in chapter 1. He was going to be in the world, but not of the world. But he wasn't a fundamentalist. We also see in 120, 248, 628, Daniel was confident in the sphere in which God had placed him. He had a unique calling, and he sought to be confident in it, and in fact was confident in it. And yet we see in 1:8, though he's involved in the world, he is prepared to be separate from it. He purposed in his heart, literally refers to him making covenant with himself. He committed himself not to partake of those things that had been sacrificed to idols. We also see in chapter 6 that he was a man of integrity. He committed himself to worship his God. He wasn't going to be pragmatic and just not worship God or just begin to pray to God on his way to work and back, but not actually get on his knees in front of his window anymore because somebody would see him. He just said, I'm just going to have to continue to do exactly what I'm doing and have been doing all along. And he was a man of integrity. So we see the Christian's place in society. Lastly, we see the place of witness in the Christian's life. Daniel was courteous in chapter 1 and 2. He was courageous in chapter 5. We find him compassionate in 4:27. We find him Christ-centered in 12:3. Over the effects of it. The effects of it were that he very well may have been the instrument by which Nebuchadnezzar himself was converted. But Belshazzar, his great-grandson, wasn't converted. But very interestingly enough, in Ezra's list of those that return in the captivity, there's a man's name there named Bigva, the Babylonian name. And so we find that even somebody that returned with the Jews was apparently a proselyte, a Babylonian who was converted and now was going to go back with the Jewish people. Later on, Esther will come on the scene. The Jews, we see in that book, obviously thought very highly, or were obviously thought very highly of by the Medo-Persians. We also see at the time of Christ that wise men from the East, the Magi, those of Daniel's type of men, those men that had a unique place in the government of the East, would come to worship King Jesus. Obviously, they had heard of Jesus through Daniel, through his companions, through the other faithful Jews that remained there in Babylon and in the East. Let us pray.